Accession number 22624, Reel 3.
Ashton, Reel 3.
Yes, the first night we were in action there, they lined up the mortars in a nice long line, straight line, in this valley of the River Oden, just on one side of this, on this, I suppose it would be the beach side, put it that way, which would be the south side, I suppose, of the river. And we did a night shoot. Well, of course, a night shoot with mortars, they have a barrel flame of about 6 foot. You get four mortars firing, say, 25 rounds, and you've got the place lit up like daylight, you know. Well, Jerry was not slow on the uptake, and he very quickly plastered us, and we lost our first casualties there. A number of people wounded. I can't remember how many now, but there was one, Corporal Reynolds, who was killed and buried there, and has subsequently never been found. We think he probably buried in a slit trench, I'd imagine, which perhaps was too deep. And bearing in mind that the place looked like the Somme, the trees were all shattered, and the river banks were all blown away, so that the whole area was just a morass of mud and water, and pretty grim place, really. And I suppose the markers that we left were perhaps subsequently knocked down by shell fire, or maybe tanks or vehicles run over it, and anyway, that's where he lays to this day. I've been back, and the person who actually owned the place was the sister of a French general who owned a mill, which is just up the road from there. And I told her about this, and she said, "Well, all the while we're here, he won't be disturbed."
Well, did any of the enemy firing land near you?
Oh yes, yeah, there was quite a number actually, and one of our Malta team leaders didn't come out of his slit trench when the order came to fire, and no names, no pactor, but he was replaced. But it was pretty grim, and considering it was our first time under fire too, you know, you get accustomed to these things as time goes on. You can identify the ones that are going to be near, but mortar bombs that fall near, you don't hear coming. As I subsequently found out when I was wounded, you don't hear them when they get you. It's, you know, it's all too quick. But that was our first action. And in that battle, which lasted perhaps, I don't know, 5 or 6 days, there was over a quarter of the division lost in casualties, which was, as far as I know, the heaviest casualties of any division in an initial, in a first sort of action, as it were.
So you were sheltering in slit trenches, weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, oh yeah, dug in slit trenches. But the mortars are actually on open ground, you see. You haven't got time or very little down, unless you're going to know you're going to be stuck there for some time. You know, I mean, we were actually on the move. The mortars are just on flat ground. If you've time, you can dig them in, you know, if you're going to be... No, you're going to be in a defensive position or something like that. You dig a mortars in, but if you're doing what we call crash actions, they were simply placed on the surface of the ground, and you shelled in your adjacent trench, and until you were called out to stand to, you know.
Can you take me through the rest of those 5 days, step by step, as you remember it?
But it's confusing now, and it's a long while ago, but I can remember going down there, and that being our first big shoot. We were, shortly after that, we were actually pulled out, and we were sent down to the American sector for a rest, would you believe? But we moved through various villages. Show was the place we were bottled up, a place called Show, where we were bottled up initially. And Sequeville in Basin, I don't know how you pronounce it, I'm sure, probably not, but... that was where we first rendezvoused, if you like, where we leagued up for the first night or two. And we moved off from there subsequently. I remember going through a series of villages and various actions, most of them quite small, quite short. Harassed by sniper fire all the time. Jerry 88s, which were absolutely spot on, you know. They were, The velocity of the 88 was the thing that took us all by surprise, I think, because the explosion of the shell, followed by the noise of it arriving, and then finally the gun being fired. So it was, of course, the 88 was actually an anti-aircraft gun that Jerry modified for use on as anti-tank weapons and ordinary field guns, of course. But numbers of blokes popping off. But I remember one particular thing. Our company clerk was a chap named Maurie Breeze. I don't know if he's still alive, but he lives in Lewis, and he was actually mayor of Lewis for a while. But he was our company clerk, and he was a good bit older than the rest of us, or he seemed a good bit older. I can remember him sitting in the River Orne, what was, you know, having a bath when it had a calm enough moment. He got his tin hat on. He's sitting in there having a sloosh, and very religious man, old Murray Breeze. Never heard him use a bad word or anything of that nature. And I remember calling out to him, "Murray, get yourself down here and you'll get your head blown off," or worse to that effect. And he's called back, "Not till the good Lord's ready, Ray." And that was Murray's reaction. He wasn't going to go till the good Lord was ready for him. But no, very calm character, Murray. But a bloke less like a soldier, you can't imagine, really. It just goes to show. It's, and then from there, we moved back to the American sector, where we went with the first American Big Five? I seem to remember it being the Big Five, but I don't know that there was a fifth infantry team. But anyway, they had a big red numeral on their shoulder anyway, an infantry drill. And there was no signs of the battle, of the birds were singing in the trees, and they were in this orchard. And they'd got big dugouts with logs on the top. You can't imagine it, you know. And we arrived, you see, and our platoon commander sort of immediately says, "Right, my group," by which he was after the OP group, you see. And this American top sergeant said, "Where's he off to?" So I said, our sergeant said, "He's going looking for some targets." "You're not going to shoot at him, are you?" He said, "Sure, we're going to shoot at him." So he said, "They'll shoot back." And our sergeant sort of said, "Well, how long do you want to stop here?" They were generous to a fault. I mean, we had lived on their rations. We had to wear their helmets while we were there so that Jerry wouldn't get the inkling that we'd arrived. And that was just before Operation Blue Coat, I think the name of it was, where the subsequent breakout came. But that was much later on, the breakout. We went down to the order, the sequence of these things I get mixed up with now. I can't remember which order they came in very often. We went down to St. Charles de Percy and the Eastry Crossroads, which was another violent do down there. And that was where Jerry had this armoured unit to stop the Americans breaking out of Mortain down on the American sector. And of course, by that time, the Americans were breaking out as we were, and swinging round. And so they were trying to pull back. We were obviously faced with either the remnants of them or one thing or another. And I can remember on one occasion there, some wounded, and we'd sent one of our bods out to bring in jock wounded. They weren't our blokes. And we'd sent some of our medics out to help bring them in. And they were fired on by the Germans. And this jock company commander was very irate about this and immediately sent the old jocks in on a counter-attack, sort them out, you know, which they did in an uncertain manner, I might add. But
how do you mean?
Well, they carried out an assault on this on the German positions and just went straight through them. And I don't, as far as I know, there were no prisoners taken. The thing in Normandy, on occasions, for the most part, the German Wehrmacht were very much like us, I think, and they gave up. I mean, I captured on one occasion two Russian blokes, so we didn't know they were Russians at the time. But I was on stand two one night, and I see these two characters moving through a cornfield towards us, and I called out, and they couldn't see us because back behind us were some woods, so I'd imagine they couldn't see us, and I just called out to them, "Howdy, Hock, you know, And they said, Nick Shearson, Russ. And when we took these guys prisoner, they got no weapons on them anyway. Took these two blokes prisoner. And we took them into our company commander, who happened to be there at the time. And what we used to call him. And because he used to always say, what, you know, a bit like an otter. And not a man many of us had any respect for, Major. And he said, have you disarmed them? What? I said, so you're going to take them in with weapons on them, you know. But now he was a senior man, a regular soldier, apparently won a well-earned MC at Dunkirk. But I don't think he should have been with us in Normandy. I think he'd lost his nerve, to be honest. And I think, I suppose we had no choice. Monty was desperately short of infantry. So I suppose anybody went. But he really shouldn't have been a company commander. I don't feel he should have been, anyway. But
what impression did these two Russians make on you?
Not a great deal, really. I mean, they were scruffy, and I just think they packed it in as soon as they could. But, of course, we didn't know then, or nobody knew then, of course, that they were subsequently handed back to Russia. It sounded a reasonable thing to do, though. They should be sent home, didn't it? But they were apparently all shot by Stalin. He'd done for the lot of them at the end of the war. But that was all in the future, of course. So we didn't know that. But yeah, there were a number of foreign troops. But the 12th SS, I think they were the worst. These young lads were indoctrinated, you know, and they wanted to die for the Führer, for which our colonel said we should do our best to grant them their wish.
Did you come across them close at hand?
Yeah, we did. We took some prisoners of them, you know. One chap particularly had been sniped. It's a wonder, really, that he got away with it, but... he surrendered, and we took two or three of these guys prisoners. They'd been left behind in a wood. I suspect they were probably hiding there, waiting for a chance to give themselves up. But they were arrogant. They were, you know, different kettle of fish to most of the Germans anyway. But the Canadians refused to take me, 12th SS prisoners. And in fact, I think we had much the same attitude. The Canadians that we were alongside us at that particular time, and I can't remember the name of the little hamlet they were in, they had some wounded, and they'd been forced to retire from this hamlet they'd captured. And they left behind their MO and a couple of medical orderlies to stay with the wounded. The next morning, they counterattacked, recaptured this place, and found they were all shot. Now, I seem to think there were about a dozen of them, but I wouldn't. But it is recorded, that event is actually recorded in some of the history books anyway. But and subsequent to that, the Canadians refused to take any prisoners of the 12th SS. And I don't think there were many taken by any other units either, come to that. They were a ruthless bunch. But that's a lot of the SS units were. But they were good. I mean, I'd hand it to them. They were good fighters. They were well trained and well equipped. Better rifles than we had. Better equipment than we had, really.
Was it easier to recognise the different enemy units?
Yeah, for the most part, we knew what units were opposing us. I think the intelligence was quite good on that score. We would be told, you know, it's the 12th SS or the 10th SS or whatever. So we had no illusions on that score. I think the intelligence must have been quite good.
What are your next memories?
Well, I suppose after the breakout, roaring up through Belgium, and we were left behind, and we didn't see much of the Falaise Gap. We weren't involved directly in the fighting at Falaise, but we had to drive through it, and I shall never forget it. Absolutely appalling. I mean, if you can imagine hell on earth, that must have been it, I think. Whole roads jammed with vehicles and a lot of horses, dead horses. The Germans used, which was a surprise to us. The Germans, we always imagined being a mechanised army like our own, but in fact employed a lot of horses on their guns and so forth. And of course there were a lot of dead horses, a lot of injured horses too, some of which were shot, some of which were handed over to farmers if they weren't too badly wounded. But dead body. I can remember we were forced to stay one night there on our move. We were halted and told to bivvy for the night. And there was literally nowhere to lie down. And we cleared an area. Our sergeant, old Tom Emerson, and myself buried a couple of Germans who simply fell apart when we tried to put them into a stretch trench. And we were violently sick, a pair of us. And the meal that night was bully and rice. And well, the rice just looked like a lot of maggots, you know. But no way, we couldn't eat the meal. But we had a cup of maggot tea, and I think that was about all we could stomach. And the next day we moved on. But we were forced to drive over bodies and things. There was no other way to get out of the situation. An appalling stench, flies. And I often wondered how long and with what horror it must have been to clear up that mess, which was the best part of the German 14th Army trapped. Most of the work was done by the typhoons, you know, who were, I mean, wonderful. We used to welcome the typhoons, they were terrific. But, the tiffies, as we used to call them. And we could get on the radio and fetch them up. You know, they'd have what they called their cab rank. They'd have them sort of circling around in the background somewhere. And if you struck opposition, you could call them up and up they would come. And from there, we raced on to the Seine, where we crossed the River Seine at a place called Vernon. And
peacefully?
No, not entirely. But it wasn't one hell of a battle or anything of that nature. But there were German snipers left behind. And there was a machine gun nest on an islet in the river, on the Seine, of course. And the IRES was putting this Bailey Bridge across at night. I presume it was the IRES attached to the 15th Scottish Division, but I don't know for sure. And we were designated to go and put paid to this German machine gun unit, which was up somewhere up the river, and open fire on them every now and again and knock a few blokes off the bridge. So we went back up the bank with a brain gun team and one thing and another, and found this islet and smothered it with fire. But it wasn't sufficient, so we mortared it. And we thought we'd finished it off, and then it would open up again, and this went on for most of the night. So, and then subsequently in the morning, it all quietened down. Now, whether the Germans we'd put paid to them, or whether, in fact, they'd withdrawn, we don't know, but obviously they were driven off in the end. And we crossed the Bailey Inn at Vernon, and then moved on up through towards Belgium. There were subsequent little clearing up battles, you know, villages to clear and woods to clear and so forth, and so, by lots of remnants of units that had been left behind. So, you know, this little fire parties here, there and everywhere went on. And eventually we got up to Belgium, where, of course, the next big do was at Geel, a place called Geel, which was across the Escort Canal. And we relieved the Durham Light Infantry there, and we were told to cross a bridge. There was actually no bridge there when we got there. It was just lock gates that had been smashed with a gap. And the jocks put a platoon across. They managed to get a platoon across initially. But there was an 88 that fired straight down the road, and there was a four-barrelled cannon, very ACAC weapon, which fired straight up the canal in long bursts. We had to cross this canal. I was then part of the OP party with a bloke named Honeychurch with me on the radio. And the other side of this river was a elevator, a mill, a flour mill. And we were going to put the OP in this place, but we've got to get across the canal first. Well, eventually, they brought up what do you call them? Not ducks. Just pontoon-type folding boat things, you know? But there were no paddles with them, and supposed to have been outboards, but apparently the vehicle carrying the outboards had hit a mine on the road coming up, so that no outboards. So we paddled across with rifle butts and our hands and tin helmets and things, all the time with odd fire coming up the canal. And subsequently got ourselves ensconced in this mill, as OP. As I remember, there were about four floors, and we got up there, and I'd got the radio and the aerial up, and only to find that Honeychurch, who was carrying the batteries, had left the batteries behind, battery leads behind, which is not a lot of use. Our officer, OP officer, called Gribble, was somewhat annoyed by this, you can imagine, sent Honeychurch back across the canal, which he wasn't too happy about. And prior to that, we'd come through this blooming dark, horrible wood, not knowing if the enemy were in there or not, you know. Honeychurch went back to get the battery leads and was subsequently wounded on the way back. So we never did see Honeychurch or the battery leads. We used the artillery's radio to give our mortars direction fire. We had another platoon there with an OP, with a chap, Lieutenant Binloss, who was a very brave man. I think he ended up leaning with his chin a bit, but it was no doubt he was a brave man. And he got himself a German sniper's rifle, and apparently accounted for 16 Germans while he was up there for a party. There were lots of incidents there, you know. One was that we'd seen Jerry moving about there, and they wore gas. I suppose they were armed, perhaps our ground sheets, I don't know. But they used to wear ground sheets across their shoulders when they moved about, which was the same as our infantry did, you see. So they, in the distance, you couldn't really tell whether they were Germans or ours, you know, so it was, there was always a chance of firing on the wrong lot. But it was a bit hellish there. And eventually, Jerry set this mill on fire. And
how?
Shell fire, and hit the top of the machine gun fire as well. But there were units above us and below us as well, as far as I know. We came down the stairs with the various equipment and this leaving this place on fire. And one of our lads then got an MM awarded there. Quite what he did, I'm not too sure. But anyway, we had to evacuate this place and get back across. And he was radio op for another one of our officers. Lieutenant, what was his name? Gerard, Captain Gerard, who subsequently became Metropolitan Policeman. And he was in charge of all the sort of ceremonies of coronations and things like that. He used to be, you know, in charge of all that. I met him subsequently. He's still around as far as I know. But his OP, radio op, got an MM. Well, we didn't get one. We were a bit miffed about this because we were doing the same job as we could, see. But that's the way of the world. It often happened, you know. But going back across, we were forced to retire from there. And it was at this time that the Arnhem do came on. So this must have been about September, because we saw the 101st Airborne go over. And then we were used on the flanks. Our whole division was used on Operation Market Garden, which was Arnhem. Of course, Market was the airborne bit, and Garden was the ground troops. And our role, the 15th Scottish role, was to keep the flanks of the road open and try and stop Jerry cutting the road, which he did on numerous occasions, most nights, in fact. We were stretched very thinly on the ground with a brigade up. All three brigades were involved in it, with one brigade up each side of the road. And our brigade was moved over further to the left towards Geel, and with the object of crossing these canals and causing a diversion to try and draw German troops off. We lost about 500 men in that thing. The brigade lost about 500 men, which was a hell of a price to pay, really. And these actions that took place by various units, subsequent to the actual drive up the road, they lost a lot of casualties, and these are not normally accounted for. You don't normally see them, you know, listed. Well, I've never seen them listed as part of the operation, but in fact they were, and there was a lot of good men went to in trying to draw off the troops, German troops, off the main drive, you know.
Any specific memories of what happened to you in Operation Garden?
I can't really remember anything out of the ordinary. For most of the time, I sat in the carrier with my helmet on and on the radio. link on a radio link back to company, to the company HQ, and forward to the platoon positions. But on occasions, just depending what was going on really, on occasions I've been employed on a mortar line if there were shorter blokes and had a number taken a few occasions, I'd be there sort of either carrying out ammo or dropping the odd one down the barrel or whatever. We were trained on everything, of course. You know, we've been trained on all the weapons the unit used. My personal weapon was a Sten gun, and the only time I ever used that in action, it jammed after three rounds, and if it hadn't been for a corporal with a Bren gun, I wouldn't be here now.
Why?
I came across a gap in a hedgerow, and just as we approached it, within a few yards of this gap, three Jerrys jumped out in front of us, armed with Smizers and thing, and over fire. How they didn't hit us, I can't imagine. To this day, I fired three rounds, and the thing jammed, because they were a flipping hopeless weapon, a Sten gun anyway. And I had a corporal alongside me with a Bren, and he shot a lot of them. And if it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't be here now. But I told our sergeant, you know, about this blooming Bren gun, you know, this Sten gun rather, which I made. And he said, "How many rounds did you put in it?" So I said, 28, because it could carry 32, but they used to be known to jam if you put too many rounds in them. So I said, "Take my, I wasn't going to, you know, enough experience not to muck about with you." And they were a cranky thing, a bit like the old Kodak box brownie, you know, you either got a good one or a bad one. They were cheap and nasty, and most of our lads, you know, done away with them. I got myself a Jerry Smizer, and that was made that my personal weapon. And after the war, when I old Gribble, he said, "Are you one of the blokes with the Sten gun?" So I said, "Yes." Yeah. So he said, "You caused me an awful lot of trouble. We couldn't account for half of these after the war." I said, "I'm not surprised. Most of them we slung away." But no, they weren't. They were a cranky thing, you know. But another chap, one of our chaps, jumped off a carrier with one on his shoulder, and just the bounce of his feet hitting the deck, fired because there was no safety catch on him as such, you know. And there was a little U clip which he pulled, but you know, if you just left the bolt forward, which we normally did, it was a big flexy old spring in it, you know, and the thing would bounce and fire, and it put a round up behind his ear, killed him, you know, which is a terrible way to die, isn't it, really, you know. We just felt that, there were a number of deaths through accidents, and we had a dispatch rider who ran into a level crossing gate at night and was killed, you know. And these sort of accidents, when you think you trained and you've gone all through the war just to die a miserable death like that, you know, with no real purpose, just an accident, it seemed particularly tragic, we felt. Another one of our chaps, a Private David, who was actually the batman to the company commander, was a good swimmer. I used to go swimming with him at Brighton. And he was killed in a very dodgy subsequent accident just after the war on a swimming party in a lake up in Germany somewhere. And they just undressed in the bushes and went skinny dipping in this lake. And when the truck was due to depart, he hadn't arrived. So they went to look for him and found him face down in the water with the back of his head bashed in. And they think it was probably the werewolves, you know, there's werewolves in it. This was immediately after the cessation of hostilities, almost within days, you know. And to die when the actual war was over. He's buried in a cemetery what's the big port up in...
Hamburg?
Hamburg, on the outskirts of Hamburg. And apparently it's a 3-kilometre walk from the gates to the military cemetery in this, you know, if he's at the back of the cemetery. So you can't imagine the size of this. I presume they were people from the bombing, you know. After the operation failed, I mean, it failed miserably, really, within 4 miles of actually reaching the target at the end of the relieving the paras on the bridge. We went to Nijmegen up through on the actual famous road, through Grave and so forth to Nijmegen, where we raced across the Nijmegen Bridge, which was still under fire, and landed on what they called the island, which was the area between the Rhine and the Waal. And we were stationed there, various little actions, mortar fire on targets that they'd found. And also, while we were there, we had a meal in an SS barracks. Now, I can only assume this must have been the Dutch SS, because the Dutch had a SS unit, 10,000 strong, I believe, which they're subsequently very ashamed of.